Accession number 26729, reel 4.
Bob Cherry, reel 4. After the airlift, were you there for the duration, as it were?
Yep. Yes, I was there for the duration, and then when the airlift finished, I was posted to Flying Training Command to take command of the communications flight there. And whilst I was there, the CNC had his aircraft and crew, and when they changed the captains, the new captain got himself into a bit of trouble by landing an ensign on the Isle of Anglesey on the way to the Isle of Man. And he was taken off the job, and I was asked to take over from him, which I did, although I had no experience on the aircraft whatsoever. It was a Devon. And after a short while of doing both jobs, being flight commander and CNC's personal pilot, I was called in front of the group captain trying to ask which job I wanted to do. I could only have one job, so I said, right, I'll still stick as flight commander. By the time I got back to the com flight offices, I'd got to ring the CNC's PSO, who rang up and said, you've just been to see Group Captain so-and-so. I said, yep. He said, did he ask you to make a choice? I said, yes. He said, well, forget it. You're doing both jobs. CNC says so. So for the next 2.5 years, I flew the CNC around the skies. And then that came to an end.
Your rank by that stage was flight commander.
Flight lieutenant.
Flight lieutenant. And were you still part of Case Tour Command?
Oh no.
That
was in Flying Training Command. I went from Coastal Command to Transport Command to Flying Training Command. And then the whole time I was there, went after the flying of CNC around for about 2.5 years. I went there and was taken off that and converted onto Meteor aircraft to become an instructor on Meteor aircraft.
Did you spend the rest of your career in training?
Basically. And after that, I went to a training squadron to convert pilots onto jet aircraft. And from there on, we moved to, changed over from Meteors to Vampire T-11s. And then we moved from Oakington, where we were stationed, down to a place called Merrifield. And there we carried on until the place closed down. And what happened then? Now, it's about this time when I went to Flying Training Command that Betty joined me for the first time. They got two children by then. So Betty joined me after 5 years of marriage.
And you were living in married quarters?
We were living in a married hiring at the time. And we stayed in the married hiring until we left Flying Training Command. The comm flight. And then when we got into the training side with the Meteors, we moved into proper married quarters. In fact, I was lucky enough to get a wing commander's quarter. Because by that time, I'm jumping a bit, aren't I? Yes, I'm jumping. When we left Merrifield, I went into Tech Training Command to the Officer Cadet Training Unit at the Isle of Man, where we were there for exactly 12 months, and then came back and went into the Air Ministry, into Intelligence, for 3 years.
What did that involve?
Well, it involved being intelligent. Mm-hmm. Getting all various information and disseminating it and passing it round to the respective people who wanted it.
About
aircraft.
British aircraft or foreign aircraft.
I mean, I was allotted a certain part of the world to look after. Those are air forces. And so I had to garner all the information I could on those air forces and then collate it and disseminate it. And that was it. And we were there for 3 years, and then we were posted to Germany to join the German Air Force to rebuild the Luftwaffe.
Can you tell me about that? What was your role?
Well, I was squadron commander there. We were there was a wing commander in charge, and a squadron leader in charge of Landsberg, and I have moved north to, strangely enough, back to Wunstorf, where I was in charge of the transport side of business and the ab initio training. Now, the ab initio training was flying the an Italian trainer at Piaggio. And what was the name of the place? Where we were? We stayed at Bukkeburg for a start, didn't we?
Stayed at where first?
Bukkeburg.
Bukkeburg.
Then we went up to... up there. Anyway, we went north. What happened was, the chappie in the south, his wife flat refused to go north. He was supposed to be going. And she flat refused to go north. And so I went north, which I delighted in, because it gave me freedom of movement, and I didn't have a wing commander breathing down my neck all the day, which he had, because they lived next door to each other in Marrick quarters, so they never got away from each other. And there was me, 400 miles away in the north, living the life of Riley.
And what was your role exactly? You were training pilots?
Training Luftwaffers. Luftwaffe pilots.
And also transport?
Yes, I mean, you've got some of the same as with the RAF. Some went into transport, some went into fighters, and some went into other things. Now, the ab initios, they were just learning to fly from the word scratch. And then when they did that, they went on to the next set, which was there were Fugger Magisters, which were down in the south at Landsberg. But it just so happens a transport unit there, which they felt we could look after it, because the chaps that was there had all had transport command experience, so we knew what it was all about. And so I had those two jobs to do. One was at Wunstorf, and one was at Deep Holt. And so we were there for the best part of 3 years.
And did you train them in English or in?
Yes, English is the NATO language. And the strange thing is, having said that, although the French were insistent that French is spoken all the time, the French Air Force always spoke in English.
And what could you expand on the role of the RAF in training the Luftwaffe?
Well, it was quite a straightforward training. We came under the command of the Germans to a certain degree, but I was given freedom of movement as a squadron commander, and I was taken in to every sort of conference that they had, and so we were absolutely integrated. As far as the instructors were concerned, they were integrated with the few German instructors that were there, and we got on like a house on fire. Had a wonderful time with them. They, the CO had said, don't ever talk about the war. And so when we got to the north and the Germans started talking about the war, I said to the chaps, carry on. And as a result of that, we had an extremely good rapport with the Germans in the north. Down the south, where they were forbidden to talk about it, the morale was pretty low. So I think, in honesty, I was right to do what I did do. So with that one, one of the things the CO had said as well, that to always turn up to any of these, what they call the Herrenabend, which was a man's evening, which is equivalent to our dining in night, in civilian clothes. Well, the first one we went to in the north, all the Germans were in as much official uniform as they could be, and that was all it was the normal daily uniform, but they're having a bow tie instead of a normal tie. And so I went over to the CO and says, excuse me, sir, please accept my apologies for being incorrectly dressed. And he looked at me and said, Jerry, it's not the clothes that count, it's the man inside. And so that was the sort of rapport we had with them. It was that good.
What was was your feelings about building up the German Air Force after having fought against them in the Second World War?
Well, it seemed quite natural. I mean, I wasn't over enthused with the Germans on the Berlin airlift because of what we'd gone through. But after the years went by and things changed, when we got to the Germans, I mean, as I say, we got on like a house on fire. It was a very happy time. In fact, in some cases, I say it's the happiest time I had in the area.
And you were there from 1956 to 1959,
wasn't it, Betty? Mm-hmm. And where we had merit quarters, we had a servant, because they insisted when the contract was made that we should have merit quarters and they should be fully furnished. Well, the Germans themselves didn't have merit quarters and fully furnished. So we first went to Buckeburg, where the army gave us some quarters, the British army. And of course then the problem was of getting them furnished. And so we had this conference with the Germans administration. And we spent all the day haggling and getting nowhere fast, because they didn't want to do it, and we said they got to do it. Until eventually the adjutant said, excuse me, gentlemen, he said, we seem to be having problems here. He said, I always thought the rules and regulations were for the guidance of wise men and the blind obedience of fools. The Germans took one look at him, turned to the wing commander and said, you have a very clever man here. What did you want? Just like that. So we got everything we wanted, and then later, when we moved up into Deep Holtz, they'd taken over two blocks of flats from the Germans, not the Germans, the German civilians. And as the CO, I had two flats knocked into one. So I had two of everything. So we, the maid we had at when we were at Celle, that's where our quarters was at Celle. We got her, and when we moved, we took her to Buckeburg, although the Germans said no, and I said yes. And it prevailed, and we took Frieda with us to Buckeburg, and then we took her back to Deep Holtz as well. So when we first had her, we were in an old German officer's quarters, and we showed her where she was going to stay, and she was absolutely shattered. She got a complete flat let to herself, complete, where she'd been living at home in the same room with about four more children. And so she was only too pleased to come with us. She was absolutely wonderful. In fact, so she wanted to come home with us, but we couldn't afford to. So I had full batting service the whole time I was in Germany.
You left Germany in 1959?
Yep.
What happened to you then?
What happened to me then? Oh, I came back to Bomber Command, as it was then, Bomber Command headquarters. The post wasn't ready for me, so for some unknown reason, and out of the blue, I was posted to the Air Ministry on a temporary basis to rewrite Air Ministry flying orders. So I was given the job of rewriting the flying orders, given a budget, and given free rein as to what to do. And so I spent the next 6 months rewriting Air Ministry flying orders.
And those are the basic rules?
They're the basic rules which the Air Force flies by. Which was quite a task in itself, which was well worth it in actual fact. Did me a power of good. So then we went into Bomber Command in the organisation branch on establishments. And so for the next 2 or 3 years, until I retired from the RAF, I was visiting the various Bomber Command stations with people from the Air Ministry to see if we'd got round pegs in square holes sort of business, and sorting the establishments out. And when it came to nearly coming out of the RAF, the CNC Flying Bomber Command was going over to the States to see and take part in what was known as Sky Shield 2. And I heard about this because his PSO was a golfing pal of mine, and I said I wouldn't mind going on that trip. And so I went to see the my CO and said, look, I says, this trip the CNC is going to America, can I go? He says, if you can give me a valid reason for going, you can do it. I said, go out and write it up. So I did, and he agreed, everybody agreed, so I went out to the States on this thing. I used the excuse of we'd got some bases, small bases in Strategic Air Command, and I was to go to all these bases and do an establishment review on them. The point being that when we got over to the States, they'd all been dispersed, so there was nowhere for me to go. So I was in on Sky Shield 2, with no security clearance whatsoever. Nobody realised that it hadn't been security cleared. So I saw Sky Shield 2 from the bridge of NORAD headquarters, and the next day went into the top secret part of NORAD headquarters to be briefed on things that I should not have been told. But I did, so I was lucky and got away with it. And that was it, so therefore, basically, they came out in 1964.
And by that time, what rank did you hold?
Finished squadron leader. What happened was that when I was over in Jerby, the officer cadet training unit, the New Year's honours list came out, and of course, at that time, they came out on New Year's Eve, and suddenly my name came out as promotion to squadron leader. That's when I went down to Airman's Threat into intelligence.
How did you feel about leaving the RAF after so long?
I was quite happy. I'd had a good career. I'd got into a higher rank which I ever thought I could possibly get. And so I was happy and content. I'd flown for most of the time in the RAF as captain of an aircraft. I'd had the honour of flying a CNC around, and so yes, I was all right. I wasn't hankering for a wing commandership. I was happy as I was, so I came out a happy man, and went into banking, and came out of banking a happy man.
Did you find it difficult adjusting to civilian life after so many years in the services?
Well, when you've been a squadron leader for 3 years, and you move into a new occupation where you are equivalent to an AC2, it's a bit difficult to come down from a squad leader rank down to an AC2. So, I mean, quite obviously, it came out in the banking. And, of course, which took a lot of people time to get used to, as it took me time to get used to.
In what way?
Well, because I just couldn't lose the squad leadership.
So you're used to having people under your command rather than...
That's right, instead of being bossed around. You know, and it was under control 90% of the time, but there was occasionally when I was caught on the hop with something, and squad leader came straight out. You know, I was back in uniform again. But it worked through in the end, and it was all right, wasn't it?
Yes. But you clambered up that...
So what?
You clambered up that ladder.
Yeah. But that's another story, dear. We're not interested in that.
So you spent the rest of your career in banking?
Yeah. And I've been retired from that 21 years.
Is there anything particularly you miss about the RAF?
Yeah. Yes. I think we both miss it. We both miss the close-knit community. It's a little world all of its own, and it's a wonderful place to be in. It's when you come into the wide, wild world and see how damned inefficient it is, and the different attitude to people. And it wasn't a question of wanting to be a boss and being a boss, because I always worked on the premise that if you couldn't ask one of your underlings to do something, and you had to give an order, you were wrong. If you couldn't get asking over properly so that he would do it for you, you didn't need to have to order him. So that I think they were the things, and It was this very close camaraderie that existed all the way through. You know, you got your hiccups now and again, but okay, so you got over them and pressed on again. So now I have no regrets whatsoever at leaving the RAF. I missed it, that's for sure. But I did keep in contact for a degree, because when we retired, they had what was known as a Headquarters Bomber Command Officers Association. And because I'd been at Bomber Command for over 6 months, I was asked to join it. And then when Strike Command came into being and Bomber Command disappeared, we felt it would be wrong for the CNC Strike Command to be president of a Bomber Command Association. So it was in a sense civilianised, and because I was working the bank, people thought, oh, what a good bloke he was, you can be treasurer. So I became treasurer of that, and then the group captain, who was in charge of a secretary, he had a series of heart attacks and popped off, so I took over the secretaryship of that. So that kept me in contact with the RAF to that degree. So it wasn't such a quick wrench as all that.
Thank you.
Thank you.